and hear my voice saying what I thought happened in 1945, is it?
Well, not quite that. I think they'll transcribe it. And
hear my voice saying what I thought happened in 1945, is it?
Well, not quite that. I think they'll transcribe it and put it with all the caveats, you know. I mean, there are... we know exactly how faulty a procedure.
Well, indeed, unless it's ridiculous evidence, what I say, because it may quite likely be all wrong.
No, it's leads. It's indications.
Misleads, I think.
Well, I was aware of the fact that the procedure was causing you some distress.
No distress at all. I only apologise for the fact that I'm no good at it, that's all.
Well, you really don't have to do that, because we're grateful for what we have, and that's it.
Well, I'm awfully sorry, but it isn't my fault exactly that I can't do it.
No, of course not. The last thing I'm doing is...
Nor do I say any ill will, whatever. No ill will of any kind. I'm only sorry that I'm no good at it, and not really interested.
I hear that too. And with your kind permission, I'll press on to do what I've come here to do.
Yes, I'll do my best to answer, but I say they weren't probably very illuminating.
I'm really going to ask you today, well, try and close some of the gaps that were left last time, and I'd like to ask you about some of the personalities and some of the atmospheres you worked in, to the extent that you can recall them. Would you mind just sitting a little sort of so that the microphone at least picks up what you say, however reluctantly?
Yes, quite all right.
I see, for example, you were at the British Embassy in Rome in 1935.
That's right.
Was that not a very instructive time with Mussolini and Ethiopia?
Yes, it was. It was quite interesting. I arrived there in 1931, which is the height of the Depression here, as you may remember. And the Labour government, I've been secretary to the Under Secretary of State, or Hugh Dalton, and that has been kind of interesting. In the second Labour government, I was doing parliamentary questions and all that, and the Labour government crashed, and I was sent to Rome and as a second secretary. And then I arrived there, and I'd say it was the height of the Depression, and I didn't care for the sort of Boy Scout atmosphere of the fascist regime as such. But you had to recognize that by that time Mussolini, who had not gone mad by then, had succeeded in, more or less coping with unemployment. We had 3 million unemployment or more in England. He didn't seem to have much unemployment in Italy. And you had to think whether there wasn't something in the idea of some kind of regime which at least reduced unemployment, even if it was fascist. It wasn't actually Nazi. It was the fascist regime was different from the Nazis. It wasn't so brutal. It was, to some extent, brutality. But nevertheless, I wrote a thing on the cooperative state, as it was called, the investigation to that, which I dare say had some influence on events. And that was sent home, and it was saying that I didn't think the conclusion was that didn't think the cooperative state would really work. But it was an interesting experiment. There were things that could be copied. And at least it was more investigation in our present awful economic distress.
3 million is about.
That was in 1932. I wrote that, sent it by the embassy. And then, of course, we were very interested in Italy, we went all over Italy, and we had a great many Italian friends, and it was a very interesting time.
Did you? Were you?
I got out just before the beginning, just after the outbreak of the Ethiopian war.
Were you aware of the sort of the League and collective security? And
well, of course I had, because during that time when I was secretary to Mr. Dalton, I went out with him to Geneva on 3 occasions, I think, as a part of the British delegation. And indeed, in those days, the League was, at the end of the 20s, was functioning to some extent, though in fact it was only run, of course, by Britain and France, effectively. The United Nations were not in. The Germans came in and out. The Soviet Union was there partially, but it wasn't in a constructive way. And of course, eventually it broke up, starting with Japan and the Manchurian aggression, and gradually crumbled. And it was quite evident that the Anglo-French hegemony, if that's what it is, was no longer operative and couldn't work. The war broke out.
Did that memory at all move you to some thoughts as to how that could be corrected in a future peace organization?
Well, I never thought that the United Nations and the League of Nations had very grave faults, notably the fact that the great powers were not present in it. And it fell substantially, and the real permanent members were only England and France. And therefore, if there was only going to be a world organization again, it would have to comprise all the great powers. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. Nor would it work unless there was a certain amount of harmony between the greatest powers. That was an undoubted fact which we all recognized and we tried to achieve.
And so as the war developed and as your work towards a future world organization took shape, you were, am I putting words in your mouth, you were very concerned to see that nothing was done that turned the great powers away from it and made them go
on. Well, that was it, but the principal objective of our foreign policy in 43-44 was in fact to achieve a settlement in which the United States fully participated and did not go neutral, as indeed they did in 1919.
Right.
Apart from that, the secondary objective was to have an organization which included all the great powers, including Russia, including essentially the Soviet Union.
Right.
Otherwise, the alternative was to build up something like which was an Atlantic Alliance, which eventually formed, but at that moment was a second best alternative, a second not so good alternative, presumably.
Where were you when the war broke out?
When the war broke out, I was in London. I was secretary of the head of the Foreign Office.
Vansittart then, was it?
I was appointed head to Van Sittart before he was kicked upstairs in 1938. And taken on by the new head of the Foreign Office, Alexander Duggan. And I was working in that capacity from 39, 40, 41, and 1939, 1940. Until the collapse of France, when Dalton was given the job by Churchill of organizing, coordinating the services of sabotage, subversion, and so on. And he chose me, which I knew very well, as his first lieutenant in setting up that organization. While I was in the Foreign Office under Cadogan, I was in fact the only Foreign Office liaison with the Secret Services. And now they can have three departments coping with that, but I did it with one there was no assistant and one lady.
And you doubtless came to know some of the people who have made some headlines since.
I don't mind. I can't recall who do you mean.
Burgess MacLean, Philby, etc., Blunt.
Well, Burgess, my only claim to fame was that Burgess, whom I met once or twice and thought was frightful, my only claim to fame is that I persuaded Dalton not to take him on in the SOE. He then gravitated to the Ministry of Information and was taken on by the Foreign Office,
right.
Eventually by Hector McNeil, which was a disaster. I always thought he was absolutely frightful. MacLean, of course, I knew, yes, quite well, and really well. And no, not very well, but quite well.
He's an able man, I think.
And very able, and extremely charming when he wanted to be. And everybody thought he was a pillar of the establishment.
Yes.
I wasn't me to suspect him. I wasn't in the security services, and I didn't know anything about it. But I thought he was, in many ways, an admirable chap. Except he did get practically drunk. And that was obvious the reason he came for that was the reason was obvious.
When you came back from Dalton, from the economic, back into the nave of the Foreign Office.
Well, I was then applied in the Treasury for about 6 weeks. Of course, they had a job for me. And then they thought up this idea of forming this new department of coping with post-war problems.
And that was a very specific, specialized brief that you were given to
think
ahead.
Chiefly economics, things like UNRWA and all that, but it was quite evident there was a political element in that, which came out perhaps later. Perhaps they didn't mean to set it up as a political planning department. That's what it developed into inevitably. Hardly be anything else.
Give me an idea, if you wouldn't mind, as to how things worked. You said the other day, rather revealingly, that you were a man who preferred paper to spoken words.
I don't like spoken words. No, I'd much rather write a further written word.
But now, in the Foreign Office, did you have departmental meetings?
Oh,
did you,
yes, all the time.
Did you clash? Did ideas float around? Did you argue?
No. Yes, of course you had arguments, naturally. There were meetings, and naturally I put forward a point of view, other points of view. No, we didn't have any rows, I don't think, particularly.
I don't mean bitter ones.
No,
but,
I don't. There was certainly, there was a, before Munich, there was an appeasement section, so to speak, headed by Ted Carr, the great historian. You know.
Yes.
And Owen and Mayley, perhaps, and Gwatkin, I dare say, who thought we must and should come some kind of arrangement with the Nazis, chiefly economic. And others who thought it was under the leadership of Van Sittert, who thought that this was really hopeless, there was no point in Hitler's outer world domination, it was that.
Right.
Which they're probably right.
What about that, which civil servant was it that Chamberlain chose, moved into number 10 as his, who became quite a political figure later on? I'm trying to remember who he was. He was
Foreign Office
he
official.
He figures the wilderness years, the Churchill thing.
Foreign Office chair?
I'm not sure. No.
Oh, you mean Horace Wilson?
Yes.
Oh, he wasn't foreign. He was the chief industrial advisor.
Yes.
And he'd been advising Chamberlain on and the government on labour matters, and then he was put into the number 10. Before, I think he was there just before Chamberlain took over, actually, from Baldwin.
Under Baldwin.
Well, I think he was put in there, Baldwin, and then he got an office there, and Chamberlain really then took him on, which effectively is his chief foreign office advisor, which was irregular, and I think probably was unfortunate.
Did he play a part at all in the? It was early days, wasn't it, as well?
Oh, yes, he played a very considerable part. He didn't quarrel so much with Alec Duggan, I don't think, and but he was always advising Chamberlain in a, what might be broadly called an appeasing direction, and he was the chief element in that respect, yes.
Much to the fury of Churchill.
Well, of course, Churchill didn't like him, nor did the Foreign Office suspected him. And I say the Foreign Office, many people in the Foreign Office suspected him. They always thought he was not a, he was a perfectly honest in his views, but he was misguided, he said, was thought.
When the... this is the question I wanted to ask. What do you feel now to have been the quality of the thinking, the writing, the planning that went on towards the eventual world organization in the Foreign Office? Do you think it was realistic? Do you think people grasped it rather well?
Well, I think so. I think they did. I think all the partners were consulted. There were some very able people there. The chief expert from the point of view of organization was, of course, Prof. Webster.
Webster.
And he was very active. And I then had many great talks with him and so on, so to speak. And,
what became
I represented,
of him,
I was more the spirit behind what's called the four power plan,
yes.
The idea that nothing would work unless the big powers were in it. And he was eventually trying to modify that in the direction of getting something more like a Security Council as it now exists.
The four powers less France.
We put up a paper, of course, it was on the wall, and we exchanged views first of all with the Americans, you know.
Yes.
And then we found that their views are not very dissimilar from ours. And we had long discussions with them. I was going to go over there before anything happened, and so on. They came over here. And we did get rather an angry American front at Dumbarton Oaks.
An angry American?
Anglo.
I'm sorry. Funny. Did you choose the delegation for Dumbarton Oaks?
No.
Cadogan
was the head of our representative of our delegation there. He chose me as his number two, effectively, in number of Oaks, yes. I did most of the work in the committee with Pasvolsky and Jimmy Dunn and Sobolev.
How would you sum up the main objectives of the delegation for that meeting?
Well, to try and get something like the Anglo-American view accepted by the Russians, I suppose, yes. Never succeeded in doing so.
With compromise?
Well, not much. No, they in the long run, the Russians tempered their strong views to a large extent, and they accepted things like Economic and Social Council, and they accepted our views more or less as to how things should work. And eventually only one issue remains outstanding, apart from trusteeship.
The voting.
Yes.
That was the council as an agency of last resort. Do you remember the regional idea that that there should be sort of regional security councils with...
Well, that was Churchill's idea, but I always thought that was slightly dotty. He hadn't thought it out. And the idea was going to be a Council Asia. You remember Council Asia? Where would the Council Asia be? In Lhasa or somewhere? Would it be in China, Japan, and India? I think it was Cuckoo. It couldn't have had a Council Asia. What would it have done anyway? You might as well have a Council Africa. He thought because he wanted a Council of Europe, then there should be a Council of Asia, but he hadn't thought it out. I think it was nuts. And even there's the idea of a Council of Europe, nobody knew. And he was quite incapable of explaining whether the Russians should be in or out, whether we should be in or out. If we were in, if we were out, what our influence should be, it wasn't thought out. What relationship would be to any central organization wasn't clear. The thing was, he hadn't thought it out. He's a very great man, but he's concentrating on winning the war. And these were just vague ideas which had really no particular meaning, my dear.
There was no one in his immediate circle who took them up and expanded them and...
Oh, no, they were too frightened of him anyhow. They didn't want to interfere with that kind of thing. He just thought about himself. I raided by Stafford Cripps at one moment, who had the slightly less lunatic views, and nevertheless we got hold of Cripps through his secretary, who was David Owen.
Yes.
And converted him, and it all went fairly well.
So I suppose really that the UN Regional Economic Commissions are the last vestige of that idea.
The regional what? Yes, the Commission for Europe, kind of thing.
And the Western Pacific and the Latin American one are the last vestiges of the Churchill Regional.
I don't quite get the point.
I'm saying that the UN now has a system of regional economic commissions.
Economic commission?
Yes.
Oh, well, the Economic Commission for Europe, that was set up, then causing the Cold War to function. It may be beginning to function a little bit now.
Oh, well, look, it's done a lot of things. Even
it didn't function really for a long time.
Well, there's also one for Asia, and there's also ECLA for Latin America.
Oh, yes, all that, yes.
And
yes,
I'm saying that historically, I suspect that these economic commissions are the last...
Oh, I don't know. I suppose they emerge from that eventually. Yes, it may be.
But they have very little political role. There is
a
Pan-American organization, of course, which does have some.
Still some. Well, less than two.
Sorry.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize. None of the other regions seem to have.
I thought they were talking about political reasons.
Well, I then diverted for a moment into the economic.
Yeah, but originally it was sort of in the way of political reasons.
Right.
Churchill. Well, I suppose there were political reasons under the Dulles theory, that didn't work very well.
Was there a big argument about setting up an economic and social council separate from the assembly? I think we're still talking about the Dumbarton Oaks.
Yes, the Dumbarton Oaks. There was a lot of talks with the Russians. The Russians eventually agreed. They didn't really touch some great importance to it. They were really only considering the political side and their role in the Security Council.
And their ability really to stop action inimical to
them? Oh, that's the thing which they always insisted on, yes.
Yes. Good. The office of the Secretary General. Do you remember anything about... what rights he should have? You know, I mean, he does have one.
Well,
thing
there was an article in 1999 was all that was agreed. I think even the Russians agreed to that, and they yes, they did. That was, I think, it was in 19. That was in Dumbarton.
That's the article which gives him the right to bring matters to the attention.
Yes, bring matters on his own initiative.
Which was rather different from the League Secretary General in that respect.
Yes, it was. Yes, but still, I think that they agreed with that. It has been used on one or two occasions. It has been used.
Oh, yes, Korea.
Yes.
Korea was a case.
Yes, well, Korea...
Yes, his commission, the UN commission in Korea, cabled him on the 25th of June 1952.
Yes. I wouldn't know.
Matter I happened to know about because I was involved, saying there's been an aggression, and it was he who called the council together and presented, for which the Russians...
The Russians were there.
Remember.
And Dunster did so after consulting the Americans, of course.
Yes, that's, I think that's the point. Let me ask, there was a British suggestion at Dumbarton Oaks for regular meetings of the council, or in some other forum, of the foreign ministers and foreign secretaries of the powers. Do you remember that?
No.
It was a proposal that there should be such meetings.
Very likely, but I've forgotten that.
Okay.
It may well be, I don't know.
Well, then the next question falls away. It says here, how great a loss has it been that such meetings have not been held?
Well, there might be meetings of security. The idea was that the foreign secretaries might come to the Security Council. Do they do
yes.
now?
Well, only when their interests are
No, but they do occasionally.
But the idea was, and it's been revived a few times since,
yes,
that
yes.
there should be a meeting in which every seat is occupied by the Foreign Secretary or Foreign Minister.
Well, you can't
some
arrange
people have
for
even suggested head of state.
You can't always arrange them, always present.
Exactly. exactly.
But there were occasions, and there have been occasions when the Foreign Minister has been there, of course, when I was there, certainly.
Oh, yes, heavens. What about some other Dumbarton issues, defining aggression? Do you remember the argument about a definition of aggression?
Well, that's a slippery aggressor. Yes, nobody's ever been able to define an aggressor. Mm. It's a legal conception, which is really you better abandon, because you never get agreement on what an aggressor is.
But, the Charter says that the greatest sin that a state
armed
can...
attack. Or act of aggression.
Yes.
It does say, but then it was never quite new. An armed attack, of course, you can define as an armed attack. That
right.
is perfectly good legal conception. But an aggression, it was never really clear what an aggression was, nor can it be.
No. But if you separate an armed attack from the provocation and the context in which it comes, well, I suppose it is the one line that you dare not cross.
Hmm? Maybe. Well, an act of aggression, everybody knows what they think of aggression is, yes. No, it was against it as such, of course. If you want to define it legally, it's very difficult.
But Chapter 7 is all about response to that.
Oh, yes, to armed attack, yes.
Right. What did you think of the American impulse at Dumbarton Oaks and later of having the UN certify human rights, individual human rights?
Well, I was never a great specialist in human rights. I had other things to do, think about, and I never got down to the human rights thing, really, in the legal sense. And I'm afraid it was outside my sphere, in a way, really, that human rights was left very much to the lawyers.
Although, of course,
it's a lawyer's paradise.
It is, but there was a... it was a political thing right from the start, wasn't it?
Because also, yes.
If the UN could take up human rights issues, be it in Honduras or South Africa, then there's something very funny about the domestic jurisdiction clause, isn't there?
Well, yes, indeed. But you had to put that in for political reasons.
Right. You've no views, have you, as to what the significance was of putting the human rights field into economic and social rather than political?
I can't remember. Perhaps I did at the time. Maybe I wrote enormous memoranda on it. It's quite conceivable.
Right. The idea of amending the Charter after 10 years or reviewing the Charter, did you have any views on that? Did you think that...
No, he thought it should have the right to amend the Charter. We didn't think that the chances of amending the Charter were high. Because it requires a great
so many
unanimity to start off with.
Yeah.
Which is extremely unlikely, and we never thought that there was much future for that. It was about what I had to put it in, of course, yes.
Somewhere I read, I think it's a view of Cadogan, which I'm trying to recall, the essence of it is that rather than have a beautifully tailored charter, strictly drafted, that wouldn't work, let's sort of ease along the three or four good chaps to begin with and then come to the charter after an evolutionary process. I think that was the...
Is he alleged to have said that before Dumbarton Oaks or after?
No, I think after, but I could be wrong on that, and it's silly.
Well, you may well have done, but it's quite true that if you can get some kind of agreement behind the scenes, it's a good thing. I never would dispute that. And that you can't always rely on the letter of the charter.
Did you have a giggle about Woodrow Wilson and open covenants openly arrived at in the old days?
When I was very young, that was.
But you believed it then when you were very young or not?
I can't remember then. I wasn't thinking about that sort of thing, I think, probably. But I dare say it was not considered very practical. Yes, it was, I think, no diplomat should think that that was really a very good thing to openly arrive at anything, not to have any confidence or discussions at all. It seems counterproductive.
So you would have inclined to have open governments privately arrived at?
Yes. Anyhow, yes, the governments should be declared what they are and explained, but arrived at, yes.
Yalta, can we turn to Yalta?
Yes, I refer you to this enormous controversy I've been having with the vets.
I've got
well, you might as well have that, because that's all, yes. And I've run to beat all that. That's what you're quite on the record. Isn't it?
Well, these are suggestions from a very bright couple of researchers. Things work that way.
Sure, but I have said everything I have, as clearly as I can say, in Encounter.
I have it.
Yes,
I
good,
the book.
Yes. By the way, what you might like to get is the record from Charlton of the discussions that I had with him on the BBC.
Oh? About when? When the book came out?
Yes, and no, that's about a year ago now.
Charlton?
You know, Michael Charlton. He's the great BBC interviewer who did Solzhenitsyn.
No, we'll get that.
You really should. That's quite impressive.
Was
quite
that television or radio, do you remember?
Radio.
And, I'll find
ask
out.
The BBC, they'll get Michael Charlton, he'll send you a comment.
Michael Charlton, I will certainly do that.
Because that is quite interesting, about all the origins of the Cold War, really.
Good.
He's an Australian origin, he is a very distinguished chap, Michael Charlton, brilliant, isn't he?
Oh, you do find the Australian.
What?
Okay, I'm joking, sorry.
What?
No, it's a bad joke.
Yeah.
I'm a South African, so I know about it.
No, he's a very good man, and he's this record, I think, is what we're having probably.
Good. We'll certainly get that. Yeah. The voting, of course, Yalta settled the voting, didn't it?
Yes, the Security Council voting.
And that was that, sorry, was that... it was your compromise, wasn't it? It was your.
Well, I suppose I was partly responsible for it, but it originated in a talk which I had to conduct at Dumbarton Oaks, as far as I remember. Yes.
How accurate is the assessment, it says here, that no significant negotiation of this voting point happened, that the proposed compromise was brought up one day and accepted by Stalin the next?
Oh, that's not quite true. I'd say we had tried to sell it to Przewalski, who was interested and consulted him in London, and he didn't hear much more from the American point of view, really, except that we knew that Jimmy Dunn wrote to me and said they were considering it, and I got back to London. That's all we heard. And then I also had a talk with Sobolev recommending it in London.
A lunch?
Yes, a lunch at the Soviet Embassy. And then the next thing we heard was that Molotov had advised Stalin to accept it, which he did. He just accepted it. So.
Your relations with Soviet diplomats, you found Sobolev amenable?
He was the best. I don't reckon, but I didn't have very much intimate relations with him except with Sobolev and everything, and Grom, of course, to some extent.
Yes. That is an amazing life, isn't it? I mean, when you
Kromyko,
think
yes. I always respect Kromyko. I think he's a remarkable man.
We want
but I believe that Trojanovsky is just as good.
Well, I'm hardly able to judge their quality, but Trojanovsky has a great deal of charm. And,
I told you, he's very intelligent, too.
Oh, yes. But that Gromyko should have been in office, in 1941 and still be the Soviet foreign minister in 1983
quite
is astonishing.
It's quite staggering.
We're hoping very much that... that he's going to respond to... He has, in fact, agreed to be interviewed, much as you are today.
You won't agree, will you?
I mean, if I ask him, tell me about your encounter with Stalin, I don't think I'm going to get
that. He wouldn't get anything out of it.
I'm sure not.
Yeah, I don't very much doubt whether he'd give you an interview.
Well, he said he would, but...
Really?
He did, yes. But they want questions in advance.
Oh,
you know what
yes,
that means.
Yes,
that means
yes,
that someone in the
well,
ministry
Well, then he reads out, he consults the Politburo, and he... It's typed out and he reads it out to you.
Right, well, that's, you know, a very small interest. It says, can you recall, and I suspect that any question that begins, can you recall, is going to give you trouble away.
Probably not.
Can you recall the British expectations before San Francisco, and how would they...
For San Francisco. Not before Dumbarton Oaks.
No. Your expectations for the results of the San Francisco conference, and were you happy with what you got?
What do you mean? I thought the charter as cogitated in San Francisco was a good document.
As compared with what you had hoped to get?
Well, it was really basic. So it was Dumbarton Oaks, and we thought Dumbarton Oaks was as good as we could get, yes.
Yes.
So all the other things, well, of course, it was modified to some extent to the rights of the assemblies, you know, and the trusteeship things was cogitated. I suppose that was inevitable. The powers of the assembly was on the whole, yes, that was an improvement, I think, probably.
An enlargement?
Enlargement?
Of powers of the assembly?
Yes, it was. The assembly's powers were enlarged at San Francisco, to some extent. And on the whole, that was a good thing, no doubt, yes. And there were all kinds of... I think the Charter of San Francisco was as good as you could get at that time. Nobody expected it to work properly if there was a Cold War, if the Russians and the Americans fell out.
It's almost really sort of built into it that it was just not going to do any good among the great powers.
It was quite clear that the majority voting in the Security Council was out, as what sort of small powers wanted, and it was impossible to get. It may have been desirable, but it was quite impossible.
Hmm.
And anyhow, the system of voting was better than the unanimity rule of the League of Nations, presumably. And to that extent, it was certainly all you could get. Nobody realized it was, nobody thought it was perfect, and it was criticized very much, particularly by the smaller powers. The position was it was all you could get. You couldn't get any more.
Right. It's interesting that after every big war, countries are concerned that it should not happen again. So that after the Napoleonic Wars, they worried about a resurgence of France, and in 1919, Clemenceau was scared that Germany would rise again. How right he was, by the way. Were you at all British views at San Francisco? Was there any reflection of a fear of renewed aggression on the part of the Axis countries, or not particularly? Do you remember that?
Well, I think that there was. Yes, there was in theory. The whole thing was supposed to not come to operations, not embody the ex-enemies until the ex-enemies were certainly no longer capable of aggression.
So
that was the theory, and the war was very close.
So
no doubt it was foolish in a way, because there was no power of the Germans being divided into two anyhow, being committing aggression in the near future. But yes, I think the thinking was dominated.